Blog Talk Radio.
Interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Welcome, friends, brothers and sisters in Jesus Christ, and seekers of the truth. But whoever you are, I know that we all share one thing in common. Don't we all want to know the truth? The truth about what's really going on here in this crazy, confusing world. So welcome to the 594th edition of SDG, Sola Dea Gloria. And the title of the message today is Endgame Update Number 10. And a bit later in this message, folks, we're going to tie it into the last of our three-part teaching on knowing the ways of God. The Bible says in Exodus chapter 33, verse 13, "Now therefore I pray thee," and this is Moses speaking directly to God in relationship, "if I have found grace in thy sight, show me thy way, that I may know thee," that I might find grace in thy sight. So I hope you stay tuned enough so we can know the ways of God. And when we know the ways of God, folks, we're going to have peace rather than panic in the midst of this confusion and chaos around us. But the bottom line, folks, is that as believers, we may be in this world, but we are not of this world. We're just God's people. And what are we doing, folks? We are simply passing through. So refuse to be defeated by the all-out Luciferian war on humanity. Be sure to stay tuned for the latest news, the forbidden news that the mainstream media will never tell you as we dive deeper and deeper into America's new 9/11 events, which are playing in slow motion while on steroids. But remember, folks, it all started with that lab-engineered, media-manipulated coronavirus heist. And as we do every week, folks, let's get started with something from last week's episode. Now, people on the right side of the scamdemic jab conspiracy have been cheering Woody Harrelson on since his Saturday Night Live appearance last week, or was it 2 weeks ago, where he said something very controversial. And what I'd like to do right now is call up that clip from Woody and just remind you what we heard Woody saying here on Saturday Night Live. And it's concerning the biggest drug cartel of all.
Hey, so the movie goes like this. The biggest drug cartels in the world get together and buy up all the media and all the politicians and force all the people in the world to stay locked in their homes, and people can only come out if they take the cartel's drugs and keep taking them over and over. I threw the script away. I mean, who is going to believe that crazy idea?
Now, if you're one of those people out there that are saying, "Way to go, Woody," that's okay. But like I said last week, folks, I wouldn't get too excited about Woody Harrelson because he isn't the truth movement savior. He's actually a pawn in the occult practice of lesser magic, specifically known as the revelation of the method. Now, about a year ago, I think it was last May, we covered the revelation of the method, but it's out in full force now. So we're going to spend some more showtime and do a deep dive rabbit hole type of adventure surrounding Woody's past. And I'm telling you, it goes way beyond his bad boy champion of the people persona. It truly does. Now, I mentioned a guy named Tom Siebert. He was a former movie critic turned Substack writer. And he provided a lot of this reference material for me. But these are things that I've covered with you on the show for years, folks. But thank you, Tom Siebert, for this information. Now, he wrote an article, and it was titled "Occult Strategy, the Conspiracy Theorists Get a Woody for the Occultocracy's Freeze-Thaw Revelations." And that's another bit of this revelation of the method, predictive programming, whatever you want to call it, the lesser magic. And Siebert points out that good old Woody's got some serious deep state occult bloodline action going on there. In fact, in his immediate family's past. And we're talking specifically about his dad, Charles Harrelson. Now, some of you already may know this backstory about Woody's bloodline. But last week I mentioned that his dad was a convicted murderer. Actually, he was a professional mob hitman. And he may have actually killed JFK. And by the way, folks, last week I tied Woody's dad to the RFK assassination. And I stand corrected. He was actually linked to the first Kennedy assassination way back in 1963 in Dallas. You know, that occult death, that occult sacrifice in Daley Plaza. Now, the deep state controlled narrative manipulators over at Wikipedia, they even gave a decent factual intro to Woody's dad, Charles Harrelson. And I want to quote from the Wikipedia. And remember, that's run by the CIA to control the narrative. And listen to what they say. Woody Harrelson was a hitman, an organized crime figure, convicted of assassinating a federal judge who in September 1980 stated that he had killed President John F. Kennedy. Now, Woody's dad later withdrew that claim. And a lot of the revelation of the method pawns often do that. And of course, the FBI immediately discounted his claim. And you know, he was actually arrested near the grassy knoll. And you know the whole grassy knoll story, witnesses saw people there. Well, let me give you the backstory on that. There's no doubt that his dad was in Dallas at the scene of this dark sorcery crime back on November 22nd, 1963, I believe it was. He was one of the so-called tramps. There were three tramps hanging out there on the notorious grassy knoll right at the time of the assassination. And some of the witnesses said that's where the shots came from. Now, the Warren Commission, it's as bad as the 9/11 Commission. You know, they had their magic bullet theory. One bullet did all that damage in that limousine. Well, folks, JFK's assassination, it's pretty clear now, was a deep state coup. And Harrelson's presence, this is Harrelson's senior. Actually, he's not a senior, he's Charles. But nonetheless, he was there on that day. Him along with two other people were arrested. And if you want all the details on this, you can go out to Jim Maher's book, Crossfire. And he reveals the CIA, FBI, organized crime involvement in the JFK assassination. I mean, he has facts and figures and citations and references. That's the go-to book on it. Now, Jim Maher is also seriously respected by the intel community. And his Wikipedia bio calls him, and listen to this, an American newspaper journalist and best-selling author of books and articles on a wide range of cover-ups and conspiracies. Notice he didn't say conspiracy theorists. Now, that's what they do to most people, but they referred to what he studies as conspiracies. Now, Mars used photographic evidence in a number of interviews to conclude that not only was Charles Harrelson one of the three men arrested by the Dallas police after JFK's ritualistic public murder, probably the murderer. And here's something very curious, folks. None of these three supposed hobos even resembled hobos. They were all clean cut. Now, that term was picked up by the media back then, just like some of these J6 narratives today about the insurrection, you know, the mostly peaceful protest with agent provocateurs from the FBI. But that's going to be something for a little later in the show, folks. So let's use some critical thinking here. Now, you know what a homeless person looks like. I don't care whether it's 1963 or today. They're not clean cut. Their faces aren't freshly washed. Their clothes aren't crisp and clean. But that's the way these three men were. And if that wasn't bad enough, the Dallas police quickly released all three men from custody. And get this, folks. If you can believe this, and I'm not making this up. You can't make this stuff up. But immediately after release, somehow the Dallas police lost all the arrest records, mugshots, and fingerprints.
What? What? Are you serious? Are you serious? Can I have some more coffee?
Oh, Paul, I'm so very serious. yet none dare call it a conspiracy, folks. Talked about that book. Now, you can read a very good 8-page rundown written by a man named Charles C. Holt over at the Lobster magazine. And he gives you a great detail on these three tramps. That saves you from having to read. Anyway, a lot of people who get too difficult for the government, you know, maybe they're going to whistleblow, maybe they're flapping their mouths too much, even if they're arrested. Many of those people get Arkansided, suicided. And that's what happened to Charles Harrelson. He was found dead in his cell on March 15th, 2007. Now, there's a special meaning to that day in the occult conspiracy world. That happens to be the Ides of March, folks. So Harrelson was 68 at the time, and the coroner said he died of a heart attack. Now, I don't know if you know it, but the CIA has a heart attack wave gun. There's patents out on it. It's a proven technology. They can aim this wave at you and cause you to have cardiac arrest. He was suicided, just like Epstein and just like JFK was murdered and Judge Alito was found dead. And then there's Vince Foster and Seth Rich and Martin Luther King and RFK. And don't forget about Abraham Lincoln. And there's so many others, folks. People who have stood up to the deep state or threatened their cover. Whatever it is, folks, if you get in the way of the deep state, what do? They off you, folks. Now, there was even a reporter recently who said they may have to do that to Trump. I have a question. Why isn't he arrested? How can you make a threat like that to a former president and a candidate for presidency? What happened? And that's their solution when people get a little too loud, when people threaten to blow their cover. Now, his son, Woody, spent a lot of his career making a mockery of his dad's crimes and the public in general. For example, the movie No Country for Old Men, Woody just had a two-bit small part, but Tommy Lee Jones, the main character, Jones was playing this aging old sheriff, and there was a line in there that he said to Woody, and I think it was in there specifically because of Woody's dad. Listen to this. He said, the criminal element in Texas is so out of control. And a little while back in San Antonio, they shot and killed a federal judge. Now, this flick was produced by the Coen brothers, and it was set in 1980. And that's just 1 year after Charles Harrelson shot and killed San Antonio federal judge John Wood. Folks, you can't make this stuff up. And the crime that he committed there was the one that he ultimately got convicted for and sentenced to life in prison. So did you catch all those little subtleties there? The revelation of the method, folks. From John Wood to Woody Harrelson. Now, Woody Harrelson also starred in a movie called Natural Born Killers. And get this, Oliver Stone, the director of the movie, also directed JFK. You connecting all the dots, folks? Now, Tom Siebert said Natural Born Killers was, and I'm quoting Tom here, a serial killer acid trip of a hellscape, which in part concerns trauma-based mind control and its sinister influence on mass murderers. Oh, and by the way, back when Siebert was a film critic, he wasn't allowed to interview Woody Harrelson about that movie, Natural Born Killers. And why was that? Because Siebert was going to ask Woody about his dad. And that topic's forbidden. Then just recently, Woody Harrelson played the 36th president, Lyndon Baines Johnson. And this was a movie produced by the washed-up director Rob Reiner, you know, the liberal nut job. This was back in 2016. And it was a bomb. And it was simply titled LBJ. And I think it may have been an unofficial sequel to Stone's JFK. But it told of the early days of the presidency of Johnson. But of course, Reiner gives zero attention to the fact that London Baines Lyndon Baines Johnson was in on it, if not one of the primary players, along with George Bush 1 in the assassination of JFK. And why? Because JFK was going to go after the money interests and stop the Federal Reserve and start to issue treasury notes. In fact, he issued the $2 bill. And just before the assassination, he was speaking at a college in Ohio, and he basically revealed his plans to get the United States back on a sound money system. Now, a bit more on all this in Ken's Corner, but right now, folks, we have to keep moving. And right now, it's time for Sister Kathy's and Brother Alex's Freaky Deaky News Update. And as we do every week, folks, let's get started with our coronavirus heist update. And I hope by now, folks, you're seeing that there are nothing but lies coming out of the media in Washington, and it is all about mind control. Call it whatever you want, predictive programming, desensitization, behavior modification, revelation of the method. It's mind control. It's a war in an unconventional sense to demoralize. Now, folks, I'm going to drop the SADS update. Now, I know it's real, and it is sad. And may God bring peace to all these families with regard to their suffering and their loss. Their loss from a sudden and unexpected death of their sons and daughters, granddaughters and grandsons, mums and dads, brothers and sisters. But I'm telling you, folks, there are simply too many of them. And we have too much to cover each week. So I just ask that you remember these families in your prayers and ask the Lord to bring them peace and wisdom, knowledge, and understanding so that this stops happening. But what I'd like to do this week is focus on some more truth that's coming out, things that we've been talking about here on this show since 2020. And the latest is what's known as Fauci's darkest day. He's been caught in bribery schemes, trying to save his skin, and it's been proven now that he repeatedly lied on the COVID origins, paid off doctors, and even former CDC chair Dr. Redfield is testifying against him now in Congress. So in this first clip, we have none other than Jim Jordan basically tearing Fauci apart. And remember, it was Jim Jordan and Rand Paul who basically exposed him during the last couple years of COVID hearings about how absurd all of it was and how many lies he has made. But listen to this clip where Jim Jordan puts Fauci, I don't think that's the right one, Jim Jordan demolishes Fauci. Have a listen to this, about 5 minutes long.
Look forward, the Democrats tell us. Focus on the future. Might have started in a lab, might have happened in nature. But here's the question I keep coming up with. If it may have been a lab, may have been nature, we're supposed to look forward, then why did Dr. Fauci work so hard for just one of those theories? Why was it so important to push one over the other? Dr. Barra said, oh, we should entertain all hypotheses. Dr. Fauci had his hypothesis, how this started. We should entertain all of them. But that's not what happened. That is definitely not what happened. 3 years ago, if you thought it came from a lab, if you raised that, you were called a nut job. You got censored on Twitter. You were blacklisted on Twitter. You were even called a crackpot by the very scientist who in late January sent emails to Dr. Fauci and said it came from a lab. They called you crackpot. Is that right, Dr. Redfield?
I think the most upsetting thing to me was the Baltimore Sun calling me a racist because I said this came from a Wuhan lab.
Dr. Redfield, you ran the CDC and you were on the coronavirus task force. Is that right?
Correct.
That was formed on January 29th, 2020. Is that right?
Correct.
2 days later, Dr. Fauci gets an email from Dr. Anderson, which says what? Virus looks engineered. Virus not consistent with evolutionary theory. Is that accurate?
That's my understanding.
Did he share that email with you, by the way, Dr. Redfield?
No.
As a member of the task force, as the head of CDC, did he share that email with you?
No.
Okay. Next day, February 1st, Dr. Gary sends Dr. Fauci another email. That email says, I don't know how this happens in nature, but it would be easy to do in a lab. Did he share that email with you, Dr. Redfield?
No. You didn't
see either one of those emails, even though you're head of CDC, even though you're on the coronavirus task force, that had been formed just 2 days, 3 days earlier.
No.
3 days later, Dr. Anderson and Dr. Gary, who told us it came from a lab and emailed to Dr. Fauci that Dr. Fauci wouldn't let Dr. Redfield see, 3 days later, they changed their position 180 degrees. The question is why? Mr. Wade, why would they change their position that fast when the only intervening event is a conference call with Dr. Fauci, the guy who wouldn't let Dr. Redfield see the very emails that they had sent him, Dr. Redfield, head of CDC on the coronavirus task force? Why would they change their position, Dr. Wade, or Mr. Wade?
Well, this question does lie at the heart of the issue. What is pertinent, it seems to me, is there's no new scientific evidence that we can see that came available between these dates, the January 31st and February 4.
Right. There's no new. I think you're... Go ahead.
So you have to ask if there were other kinds of influence available. Now, it is true that Dr. Fauci and Dr. Farrey in London were very powerful research officials, and between them they controlled...
I read your testimony. I saw
okay.
that. Yeah.
So
why don't you cut to the chase and tell them what you really think was the reason?
I don't know what the reason was.
I know what it was.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I'll let you say it because I read your testimony. I think you said it in your testimony, too. Maybe you're reluctant to say it here, but go ahead.
Well, if you're looking at the timeline, on May 21st, a few weeks after the Nature Medicine article had come out, two of the signatories of the original email to Dr. Fauci, that's Dr. Anderson and Dr. Gary, were awarded a $9 million grant for the...
So there's 9 million reasons why they changed their mind. I knew you'd get to it. I read that last night. 3 months after, so 3 days after they say it came from a lab, they changed their position, and the only intervening event's a conference call with Dr. Fauci and Dr. Collins, again, a call that Mr. Redfield was not allowed to be on, the head of CDC and on the coronavirus task force. And then 3 months later, shazam, they get $9 million from Dr. Fauci. Well, isn't that something? Isn't that something? That's why we want to talk to these guys. That's why Chairman Winstrom wants to bring in Dr. Anderson and Dr. Gary and ask them a series of questions so we can get to the bottom of this, so we can move forward and deal with this. Now, here's the key question. Look, I'm just a common sense guy from Ohio. I majored in wrestling in college, but I got a degree in economics. You're supposed to get a degree when you go to college. I got one in economics. And one of the things they tell you about is a thing called opportunity cost. So when you're spending your time making sure that the country believes only one of these theories, you could have been doing what Dr. Redfield was doing in our government, trying to figure out how we deal with this virus. And what was Dr. Fauci doing? He was trying to cover his backside, and everybody knows it. And that's the part that ticks us off, because this is the highest paid guy in our government getting all kinds of money to tell us things that were not accurate, because we now know. U.S. tax dollars went to a lab in China, a lab that was not up to code, a lab that was doing gain-of-function research, and that's where this thing most definitely came from. And Dr. Fauci had to prove, no, he can't have that news getting out. And that's why he did what he did, to the exclusion of a brilliant guy running our CDC, kept him out of the loop. Keeping him out of the loop probably, potentially could have harmed America. That's the thing that ticks us all off. And that's why, Mr. Chairman, this hearing is so darn important, and we get to the bottom of really what happened. I yield back.
So there you have it. The fraud Fauci perjured himself to Congress with his lies to Senator Rand Paul and Jim Jordan. And he still walks free, folks. You know, this game of Fauci, the CCP paid off fraud Fauci, knew his virus would be unleashed purposely. Remember that, folks. Remember we played that? And it was done to create Election Day chaos. Do you remember all this? I have the clip right here. 2017, Dr. Fauci predicts a disease outbreak during Trump's administration. Folks, this was all planned. Let's have a listen.
Back in 2017, at a forum on pandemic preparedness at Georgetown University, Dr. Fauci made an interesting statement. Fauci told the audience the Trump administration will not only be challenged by ongoing global health threats such as influenza and HIV, but also a surprise disease outbreak. That was quite a prediction considering it was back in 2017. Here is the video.
That I have been around for a while and have had the opportunity and the privilege and the pleasure of serving in five administrations. I thought I would bring that perspective to the topic today, is the issue of pandemic preparedness. And if there's one message that I want to leave with you today based on my experience, and you'll see that in a moment, is that there is no question that there will be a challenge to the coming administration in the arena of infectious diseases, both chronic infectious diseases in the sense of already ongoing disease, and we have certainly a large burden of that, but also there will be a surprise outbreak. There will be a surprise outbreak. There will be a surprise outbreak. And I hope by the end of my relatively short presentation, you will understand why history, the history of the last 32 years that I've been the director of NIAID, will tell the next administration that there's no doubt in anyone's mind that they will be faced with the challenges that their predecessors were faced with.
There you have it, folks. We've been playing that clip for, what, the last 2.5 years? This man is a criminal. This man is worse than some of the Nazis who did all of those horrendous experiments on the people in the concentration camps. Yet he's walking free, and not only is he walking free, but he has two bodyguards, and he has the highest pension of any U.S. government official or employee. Now, CDC Director Redfield, continued in this testimony with a few of the other congresspeople, and I thought it might be worth playing some more of this. This is explosive facts, and it's not being covered on the mainstream media. This stuff was on C-SPAN, folks. C-SPAN. You know what the listenership of C-SPAN is? You know how much time it takes to find all this information? So do you think the average American people even knows this is out there? That's why we're spending this time, folks. Send this clip, send this message I'm doing right now to your friends and family and have them listen to it. I scour the media all week long looking for the important information, the forbidden news that the mainstream media won't tell you, like I say in the opening. So share the information. Let's have a listen to further testimony by former CDC Director Redfield, as he states that he was actually excluded from a lot of the communications on Fauci because he held a different view concerning the origin of this pathogen.
Thank you, Chairman. For 2 years, myself and the other Republicans on this subcommittee connected the dots. We exposed the evidence supporting our strong belief that COVID was developed and leaked from the Wuhan lab. And during those same 2 years, the same Democrats that sit on this committee, they only hindered, they obstructed, they refused to hold hearings and get to the truth. Now we see mounting evidence supporting the COVID-19 originated from the lab in Wuhan, China, run by the Communist Chinese Party. And this hearing is about getting to the truth. I thank the chairman for making this the very first hearing, because the American people who have seen just as many fellow Americans die from COVID, as nearly as many die from COVID that died in every war since the American Revolution combined, deserve to know the truth. Dr. Redfield, you pointed to the lab leak theory even before we did. In mid-January of 2020, you expressed concerns to Dr. Fauci, to Jeremy Farrar of UK's Wellcome Trust, and to Dr. Tedros of World Health Organization that, quote, we had to take the lab leak hypothesis with extreme seriousness. And you urged Dr. Fauci to investigate both the lab and the natural hypotheses. Shortly thereafter, on February 1st, Farrar convened a meeting of a group of 11 top scientists across 5 time zones and asked Dr. Fauci to join, and he wrote, quote, my preference is to keep this group really tight. Obviously, ask everyone to treat in total confidence, unquote. Dr. Redfield, you were excluded from this call, but up until then, you had been on every single, you were included in every other conversation. What changed? Why do you think that you were excluded from these conversations?
Thank you very much. I think just to emphasize, in early to mid-January, I did have multiple calls with Fauci, Farrar, and Tedros about how important I thought it was that science get engaged in aggressively pursuing both hypotheses. I also expressed, as a clinical virologist, that I felt it was not scientifically plausible that this virus went from a bat to humans and became one of the most infectious viruses that we have with humans. All viruses are not the same. So when you look at coronaviruses for SARS and MERS, for example, when they entered the human species, which they did via an intermediate, they never learned how to go human to human. Even to this day, they don't know how to go human to human. So you can't equate Ebola with a coronavirus.
Now, why do you think you were excluded from those calls?
Because it was told to me that they wanted a single narrative and that I obviously had a different point of view.
Okay. In emails following the conference call, four of the 11 scientists told Fauci that they all found the genetic sequence inconsistent with expectations from evolutionary theory, basically what you're saying. However, just 3 days later, these four scientists had drafted a paper arguing the exact opposite, and that's now the infamous proximal origin of SARS-CoV-2. Our investigations show this paper was prompted by Dr. Fauci, among others, with a goal to disprove the lab leak theory. What is the likelihood that these scientists came across additional information just 3 days after making these statements to conclude with such certainty that COVID-19 came from nature instead of the lab leak that they thought it was 3 days earlier?
Yeah, I think it's unfortunate. Again, I've said this before, that this whole approach that was taken on February 1st and subsequently in the month of February, if you really want to be truthful, it's antithetical to science.
Thank you.
Science has debate, and they squashed any debate.
Thank you. Given what we know now and looking at all the conversations in February of 2020 and before the release of the paper, do you think that Dr. Fauci used this paper to hide the gain-of-function research created this virus?
I can't talk about Fauci's motivation.
Do you think that the paper does hide the truth?
I think it's an inaccurate paper that basically was part of a narrative that they were creating. Remember, this pandemic did not start in January at the seafood market. We now know there was infections all the way back into September. This was a narrative that was decided that they were going to say this came from the wet market, and they were going to do everything they could to support it to negate any discussion about the possibility that this came from a laboratory.
I got 20 seconds left. Dr. Fauci was affirmatively told in an email that NIAID had a monetary relationship with the Wuhan Institute through EcoHealth Alliance. He was told this in January 27th of 2020. Do you think that Dr. Fauci intentionally lied under oath to Senator Paul when he vehemently denied NIH's funding of gain-of-function research?
I think there's no doubt that NIH was funding gain-of-function research.
Is it likely that American tax dollars funded the gain-of-function research that created this virus?
I think it did, not only from NIH, but from the State Department, USAID, and from DOD.
I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Now recognize Ms. Ding.
What can I say, folks? It's all right there. Everything we've been talking about for the last 3 years here on this show concerning Fauci, his lies to Congress, and the gain-of-function research that was funded by his agencies and paid for by you and me, we the people, folks. It's all right there, and it's coming out. And the mainstream media is derelict at their duty because they are not covering this because it doesn't fit their narrative. You know, you can get really worked up on this stuff. You really can. So I stumbled on this by the, the Breakers or the, did I put their name down? Oh yeah, Boat Rockers. Have a listen to this. It's done to the Village People YMCA tune, and it's called Pillage People or mRNA by the Pillage People. Have a listen.
Man, there's no need to feel down. I said, some man, if you can't go to town. I said, some man, cause we're in a lockdown. There's no need to be unjabby. Some man, there's a place you can go. I said, some man, where your mind will be blown. You can't say that.
So what do you think, folks? How was that? And without further ado, folks, let's keep moving. It's time for our Kabuki Theater update.
COVID-19, George Floyd, Rice, BLM, police reform, the 2020 elections. All merely coincidence? I hardly think so. Folks, it's called Kabuki Theater. In Japanese, ka means salt, bu means dance. Ki means skill from the verb, kabu meaning to slant or display. Folks, it's all a lie. It's the flatten the curve. The curve of the economy, stupid, must slow down the velocity of money. Portal hyperinflate before we're done. Stealing it all, Trump, bad, must go. Good is bad, bad is good. Up is down, light is dark. It's all Kabuki Theater, folks. Prepping the masses for agenda 2030 and the new world. Just say no to it all and wake up before it's too late.
And praise the Lord, folks, the masses are waking up. The prophet Hosea said, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Well, knowledge is power, folks, and when you apply it, it becomes wisdom. So it's been a year since the Ukrainian Kabuki theater with Russia and the military action over there has started, and the truth is finally leaking out. I have two clips worth listening to today. Now, this first one goes back to 2015. When economist Michael Hudson was being interviewed, and he explains how the U.S. funds these front groups. He talks about Al-Qaeda, and then he talks about the Nazis in Ukraine. It's a 2-minute, 15-second clip. Let's have a listen.
Brzezinski was the strategist for Jimmy Carter and convinced Jimmy Carter to say, look, the Russians are dominating Afghanistan with a civilian secular government. Let's create a new organization. Let's create Al-Qaeda. Let's back Osama bin Laden and give his supporters weapons to begin fighting the Russians, and we can pull a coup d'etat there, and the Russians will fight back, and then we'll say the Russians invaded. And it worked. Saudi Arabia made a deal with America that they would push the Wahhabi extremists, the Al-Qaeda, the most right-wing wing of the Islamic parties, and it worked. Essentially, Al-Qaeda is a contract army for the United States. Well, the same thing was happening in Russia. What Brzezinski wrote was that America's faced with a possibility of not being able to rule the world unilaterally, and that would be a disaster for democracy. That we can't let any country's economic ability to be self-sufficient means potential military power. And in order to prevent any country from threatening America militarily, you have to prevent it from developing economically. The American nightmare, Brzezinski wrote, was that Russia would get together with Germany and with Western Europe, creating Russian raw materials, German industry, and somehow, finally, Russia would become westernized. America, under Brzezinski's strategy, said this would be a disaster because if Russia's westernized, if it becomes democratic, if Europe and Russia are prosperous, then we cannot control them anymore, and they will have no reason to be NATO. We've got to stop Russia, and the place to stop this Russian-European conglomeration is to split it right at the border down Ukraine. Let's do in Ukraine what we did in Afghanistan. Let's back the crazies. Well, most of them are the former neo-Nazi groups that have been so prominent that fly the Nazi flag.
That's right, Gomer, but it's actually no surprise. This is more of the occult method, revelation of the method, and more, like I said, later on that in Ken's Corner. So we've been saying since day one of Russia's military action in Ukraine that it was due to all sorts of violations, violations that go all the way back to Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan when the Berlin Wall came down. Promises made in perfidy by the United States government against the government of another sovereign nation. So they kept pushing and pushing and pushing, testing the boundaries, all along doing what Michael Hudson said there, trying to destabilize Western Europe, especially Germany, and not allowing Russia to grow into any kind of industrial power. The only thing I disagree on what Michael Hudson said was Russia is already a Western nation. People have this notion that they're primitives or something. But all the way back to the time of the Tsars, this was a civilized country with the arts and music and science. It's a very civilized country, folks. Now, the truth is, like we've been saying all year concerning this painful matter in the Ukraine, the U.S. is funding neo-Nazis in Ukraine. They are. And I have another clip here because people even in some of the most socialistic countries like Great Britain are starting to speak out against it. And this next clip was on Great Britain News, and it's David Curtin. He's the head of the Heritage Party. He's speaking out against – have a listen.
Join us. David, if I could start with you. Look, you know, Ukraine was a sovereign nation. It was attacked and invaded illegally by a dictator who rules the end of the Soviet Union. Surely those of us who believe in the rule of law and international stability should be doing everything we can to make sure that Ukraine prevails, shouldn't we?
I don't agree with what you said in your question there. There were some opinions you put in there. And the thing is, with this conflict, it's actually started in 2014. We had the Minsk agreements where there was an agreement between NATO powers and Russia and Ukraine to give Crimea autonomy and to give the Russian-speaking people in the Donbass autonomy as well. But those agreements are broken. And what you have is the Ukrainian regime, the Poroshenko and then the Zelensky regime afterwards, have been bombing and shelling ethnic Russians in the Donbass area for 8 years. With 14,000 people at least being killed. And so I think what's happened there is that Putin has basically gone in what he calls a special military operation in order to try to protect the lives of Russian people in the Donbass, because Western governments in NATO were actively arming the Ukrainian government, which actually is filled with real Nazi battalions like the Azov Battalion and the Right Sector and so on. So it's not quite as how you laid out in your question. And the thing is, I think people in this country are completely fed up of it because it's got really nothing to do with the lives of ordinary people in the UK and are fed up of the government in power in London.
So there's enough there, folks. You have David Curtin, leader of one of the political parties over in Great Britain, speaking out against this lie. So it's becoming very apparent that the mainstream media isn't reporting truth, but rather what they're doing is advancing a narrative of the global elite who are planning the Great Reset, the throne of the Antichrist, whatever you want to call it. And the federal government is in on it, along with our media And sure, it's disturbing that they're lying about Ukraine, but closer to home, it's also alarming that it's coming out now that they lied about what happened on January 6th in Washington, D.C., back in 2021, when the votes were supposed to be certified in Congress, the electoral votes. Now, we've been telling you that clear back in 2020. Well, you know, this week, the bombshell hit on Monday night on Tucker Carlson, and he played the first of what was supposed to be an entire series of exposés concerning the J6 videos. And it triggered none other than the liberal Ken Burns. And he was on CNN boohooing about how he was triggered by what Tucker Carlson did. And listen to what he had the nerve to say.
Moved enough to write about this bill and what's going on with the whole idea of critical race theory and not teaching the full history of this country. Why?
You know, what makes America great is not the suppression of ideas or the pursuit of every corner of those ideas may lead us or the facts. It's about who we are and how we investigate who we are and celebrate the diversity of who we are. All of these bills that DeSantis and others are doing limit our ability to understand who we are and are not inclusive. They're exclusive. They're narrowing the focus of what is and isn't American history. It's terrifying. It feels like a Soviet system, or, you know, the way the Nazis would build a Potemkin village. Tucker Carlson's doing the same thing with the footage from 1-6. It's just a kind of rewriting of history at the most dangerous level. It's a huge threat to our republic. I'm doing, Don, a film right now, working on a major series on the history of the American Revolution, and I can tell you that Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine and George Washington and John Adams and James Madison and Alexander Hamilton are rolling over in their graves if they think that this person is carrying the mantle of what it is to be American.
You know, folks, every day is upside down day on CNN. These nut jobs, including Ken Burns, actually believe their lies. Critical race theory is not history. It's an ideology denigrating white Western civilization. You know, the civilization that brought you everything you have right now, from this very platform you're listening to my voice on, to the vehicle that's going to take you to the modern food center or food mart this afternoon, where just-in-time delivery technologies through computer integration and all the various inventory controls get you that fresh produce right when you want it. That was all brought to you by this terrible white Western civilization. So, you know, this Ken Burns actually had the nerve to say that the founding fathers would be rolling over in their grave for what? For Tucker Carlson speaking the truth? You know, we're going to hear in this next clip concerning Tucker Carlson actually did this Monday, that Officer Sicknick was walking around after he was supposedly murdered by the J6ers. So the J6 committee and the media, they continue to propagate that he was murdered. So who's rewriting history? Plus, is releasing footage of the Shaman J6er, what was his name, around with the buffalo horns on, being escorted by Capitol Building police, showing that video is rewriting history? No, Tucker Carlson is revealing the lies of the J6 committee, along with the mainstream media. You know, these demon rats, along with the traitor Cheney and all the rhino Republicans, have lied to we the people for nearly 2 years concerning what happened in the Capitol on J6. And you can see it all in the video. Now, the actual destruction of the Capitol was by FBI plants, agent provocateurs, Antifa. And what I'd like to do right now is take Tucker Carlson's J6 clip from Monday night. And this is some of his commentary. So let's take a look at this. And it's a video update. I have two of them. So the first one I want to play is just his J6 video update. Have a listen to this.
So the defenders of democracy are out defending democracy again. They're telling you it's really, really dangerous, and anyone would get to see the thousands of hours of surveillance footage from January 6th, which has been hidden from the public for 2 years, as a tiny group of people gets to make up stories about what happened that day and change the country on the basis of those stories. And we respectfully disagree. We think people should, in a democracy, be allowed to see what their government is doing and get as much evidence as they can. And it turns out the public agrees. Rasmussen, the polling firm, just found that 80% of American voters believe it's important that the public should be allowed to see the videos from January 6th. That would include 86% of Republicans, okay, but it would also include 78% of Democrats, 78% and 75% of independents. Wow. So you're defending democracy, but you're denying people information on the basis of which they can make their own decisions. How does that work exactly? Well, it's not democracy, of course. It's building a bulwark against your lies being revealed. And they are lying. And we know that because we've been looking at the tape. We're going to bring you information on the tape and some of it next week. And we think it's going to be really, really interesting.
So we played that one last week. And Tucker had already seen some of it. So then this week, Tucker exposes three things. The officer was still alive after he was supposedly murdered on J6. The shaman wasn't doing anything radical or violent. And he's got 4 years now in prison for what did he do? He violated a law. He trespassed on public property, but nonetheless it was trespassing. That's 30 days in prison, folks. And then Ray Epps claims that after he did a few things, times, that prove that Ray Epps perjured himself to the J6 committee. Let's have a listen to that.
One of the enduring mysteries of January 6th is the role that intelligence and law enforcement agencies played in the events of that day. We know there was some number of undercover federal agents in the crowd at the Capitol. Officials have since admitted that under oath. But what exactly were they doing there? The January 6th committee worked hard to hide the answer to that question. We do know from contemporaneous videotape that a mysterious figure called Ray Epps encouraged the crowd to go into the Capitol. For some reason, Epps has never been indicted for that. But there's no question he did it.
We need to go into the Capitol!
Under public pressure, the January 6th committee finally interviewed Ray Epps. Epps told the committee that he never entered the Capitol and therefore never committed a crime. His text messages showed that at 2:12 p.m., he boasted to his nephew that he had, quote, orchestrated the protests at the Capitol. He admitted he helped get people there. Yet, curiously, congressional Democrats consider Ray Epps an ally, not an insurrectionist. Tonight we can tell you that at the very least, Ray Epps lied in his sworn testimony to the January 6th committee. Epps testified that when he sent the text messages to his nephew, he had already left the Capitol grounds to return to his hotel room. That is not true. The surveillance footage we found shows that, in fact, Ray Epps remained at the Capitol for at least another half an hour. You're seeing that on your screen now. What was Epps doing there? We can't say, but we do know that he lied to investigators. The January 6th committee likely knew this too. Democrats had access to the same tape, yet they defended Ray Epps. No honest investigation would do that.
So there you have it. That was Monday night this week. And then Ken Burns comes out and the entire establishment media starts all of their damage control and Congress, from Chuckie Schumer to the Turtle. They're all out there speaking against Tucker like he's some kind of insurrectionist himself. He's a journalist, folks. And then there starts to be some buzz that Tucker's going to get silenced. And apparently those rumors were true because Tucker softens the J6 reporting and then it kind of fades out into nothing. So the real headline ought to be that Tucker Carlson caves to the establishment and perpetuates the cover-up. So after Monday night's bombshell show, and it was explosive, folks, so to speak. So Tucker exposed those three narratives as lies. The officer, Sicknick, wasn't murdered by the protesters. Tucker actually showed that he was unharmed. Secondly, the QAnon shaman, Jacob Chansley, I think his name was, didn't commit sedition. He simply marched peacefully through the Capitol with escorts, the actual Capitol Police. So if he was guilty of anything, he wasn't guilty of insurrection. He wasn't guilty of sedition. He was merely guilty of trespass. And then finally, Ray Epps wasn't some patriotic whistleblower. No, no. He perjured himself before the committee. He lied to the U.S. Senate. And then we saw, actually he lied to the J6 committee. I think that was a congressional committee from the House. But let's get back on point here. Then what happens to U.S. senators? Both the majority and minority leaders, Schumer and McConnell, jump into action. And Schumer actually has the nerve to say that Tucker needs to be silenced. What happened to the First Amendment, folks? Schumer went to the Senate floor and literally threatened Tucker Carlson and Fox News for daring to show video evidence that contradicted their narrative. There was no insurrection, folks. This is all kabuki theater. And it's part of revelation of the method, because nothing's going to happen with this. And then later, before his concussion-inducing fall, Mitch McConnell sided with Schumer. You know, the rhino. They're coming against we the people. Folks, those are our videos. And I think McCarthy, who's also bought and paid for by the Chinese, said, "Don't. This is just the red-blue paradigm here, folks. This isn't true truth. They're stirring the pot." But McCarthy did say he's going to release all the tapes to the public. But what happened after Monday night's show? Well, Tuesday night's show was watered down. He didn't release any more video. Tucker just interviewed a Capitol Police officer, and that was a rather subdued interview. Plus, there were no big reveals on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday night. And here's how everything has been reported since that outrage by the media and the government. Here's Tucker Carlson's continued reporting on the J6. All right, folks. I think Tucker Carlson was either threatened or bought off. Now, some are saying that Rupert Murdoch's and the Fox News management forced Tucker to change his show plan. And the investigative reporter who has actually woken up, Cheryl Atkinson, tweeted out earlier this week that Tucker's show plan was changed. And apparently she was onto something when she tweeted, "Murdoch shut Tucker down." Folks, off the top of my head, I could say this without stutter or stammer. I could say that Tucker should have shown those other videos of Ray Epps. And don't forget the FBI scaffolding man and the black ski mask guy and the guy flashing his credentials, his FBI credentials, when he was going to be arrested. And what about John Sullivan and his handler? You know, Sullivan had the exclusive footage for CNN. We actually talked about the contract from Sullivan where he says, "We made it." In fact, let me type up Sullivan here. I think I might have a couple clips of Sullivan. Do we have something we could play of Sullivan here? John Sullivan. This happens every time. I don't know what happened to that clip of Sullivan, folks. I don't have it. Anyways, John Sullivan was the man who said he wanted to rip Trump out of his Oval Office by his red hair. That was in the protest back before the election in Washington, the violent election where more officers got hurt by Antifa than got hurt on the J6 protest. But nobody talks about that. Tucker should have talked about all that. Plus, Tucker should have pushed for the Fed to round them up and have Ray Epps and John Sullivan give testimony and get prosecuted. So why didn't Tucker debunk the outlandish claim of the deep state that four other police officers died today? That's all out-and-out lies, folks. The truth is that these five officers didn't die on J6. Five patriots did. We don't talk about that. No officers died in J6. The one officer, Brian Sicknick, he died the next day of natural causes. And then the other four, those other four folks, over the following weeks, guess how they died, folks? Guess how these other four officers died weeks after the J6 protest? They died from suicide.
What?
That's right, Paul, suicide. Or should I say, maybe they were suicided. And then the question is, would they be suicided? Did they know too much? Were they going to become whistleblowers? Was the once great Project Veritas about to release a video on them? Whatever it was, folks, whatever caused them to die needs to be revealed, just like Charles Harrelson's death by heart attack at 68 in the prison where he was staying for life for the murder of the judge in Texas. Folks, we are not being told the truth about what happened on J6 in the Capitol. That protest didn't kill these officers. Well, enough said, folks. I have to keep moving. And right now, it's time for our newest segment, Follow the Yellow Brick Road.
Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road.
Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Follow, 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 follow the Yellow Brick Road.
Now, for the new listeners out there, we know the love of money is the root of all evil. And how do we know that? Because the Bible tells us so, folks. And we also know that if you want to find out what's going on, follow the money trail. And in The Wizard of Oz, the money trail was the yellow brick road, the road paved with gold, the money standard of the time, being threatened by none other than the silver interests of the West. But what I'd like to talk about today is Shark Tank's Kevin O'Leary. He was interviewed recently on CNN, and you probably know him as Mr. Wonderful from the Shark Tank. He's a businessman. He invests in all these new startups that are aired on the popular show Shark Tank. Recently interviewed on CNN where he said the blue states like Massachusetts, New York, California, they have become uninvestable states. And he said it's pointless to start a company in these states because once you're successful, you're punished with taxes and all sorts of punitive regulations. He even called out AOC and Elizabeth Warren by name, and he offered concrete examples of companies that he has moved to other states like South Dakota and even of other countries. So let's have a listen to Mr. Wonderful on CNN. This is a rather long clip, about 9 minutes, so stay with me here, folks.
The thing this morning, welcome back. We'll tell you what the thing is in a moment. We hope your Friday is off to a great start. We're taking a closer look at the economy, the job market. One of the important indicators we use to measure the health of the economy is the number of first-time jobless claims for unemployment benefits. That number fell to 190,000 last week, about 2,000 fewer than the week before. It means the labor market is still pushing along strong, like 7 weeks straight of jobless claims under 200,000. So who better to chat about this and a lot more? Shark Tank's Kevin O'Leary has invested in more than 50 companies, employs about 1,500 people.
All venture startups, average size about 30 employees.
Does it annoy you when people call you Mr. Wonderful? Or?
No, I think it's an honor. You know, we think it was Barbara 15 years ago. It was very facetious when I offered the first royalty deal on Shark Tank. She said, oh, aren't you just Mr. Wonderful? And I said, yes.
Like, actually, I like the sound of that.
Barbara I do Corker. Like the sound of that. My wife does not call me Mr. Wonderful. I can guarantee you that.
Okay, so let's just start with why on earth it's so hard to hire and keep good employees these days.
Over the last 3 years, there's a new generation of worker, particularly in financial services and in technology around engineering, that has no intention of working in an office. They never have. They never will. People keep saying, oh, they're all going to come back. They're not. So when you're out there hiring now, part of the negotiation is where they're going to work. And so if you're competing, which we still are, because unemployment's under 4%. This is an extraordinary economy.
Yeah.
We're supposedly going to a recession at full employment. It makes no sense. But the reality is pumping $3 trillion into the economy has provided a lot of liquidity. So we're hiring every day, and we're competing every day. and we cannot get them in the office. 44% of our employees now across our venture portfolio work remotely, and they ain't coming into the office, period.
Wow.
That's it. That's just the way it's going to be.
How's that for productivity?
I found that it hasn't changed anything because they don't know anything else. Some of them just got out of college and started working out of their homes. They've never worked in an office. Basically, what it changes is it's project management. You say to somebody, look, you got to get this done by next Friday at noon. You don't really care when they do it, and they're not working 9 to 5, as long as it gets done. So it changes the way you manage these companies. You're now project management on everything. It's not 9 to 5. However, there's probably less private time on weekends. I call my employees 24/7. That's the deal. If you don't work in the office, I can call you at 2 in the morning. If we've got a crisis, and they're going to answer. That's the way they're used to it now. And we have people working for us in India, in Vietnam, in Cambodia, in France, Switzerland, everywhere, that have different skill sets. And here's the one thing that nobody saw coming, and this is the competition of states. I don't put companies here in New York anymore, or in Massachusetts, or in New Jersey, or in California. Those states are uninvestable. The policy here is insane. The taxes are too high. We put them in Fargo, North Dakota, because 40% of the people work elsewhere, including Boston. So I was, you know, a bit of a debate with Elizabeth Warren about this, but I say, look, Senator, we've got to move the companies out of your state because you're not investable anymore. You're punishing people if they're successful. You overtax them. You hit them with a super tax. New Jersey, what a mess. New York, uninvestable.
Wait,
California.
Why is New York uninvestable?
Try and do a project in New York. Try and build
but
a
yeah,
data.
Yeah, I'm asking, Don's point, is it beyond the taxes?
Oh, the regulatory environment is punitive. I had a project in upstate New York behind the grid in Niagara Falls for electricity, a global data center we were building. Eventually, it got so bad with the politicians in the local region and the state policy, we moved it to Norway and all the jobs. Norway has it now. Thousands of jobs coming out of that. I mean, that's New York, uninvestable. Sorry, don't shoot the messenger, just telling you the way it is.
Yeah,
that's it, uninvestable.
Some pushback from our elected officials in New York on that.
I was just going to say Kathy Hochul.
Yeah. But
I'll debate them any time of the day you want.
We would love to set
that
up. Particularly
AOC. She's great at killing jobs. She kills jobs by the thousands. You know another New Jersey problem? Where did Amazon take their jobs? They took them away from her. She threatened to sue them if they created jobs. I mean, this is a reality. This is a reality that
there's a little more to it, but let's not relitigate that.
Well, you know, sorry, just telling the truth.
He's saying what a lot of people are saying, especially what happened with that Amazon thing here in New York. Just real quickly, then I don't want to hog the conversation, but what was Elizabeth Warren's response when you said that to her?
Look, I have a lot of respect for her because it's okay to have a debate about politics, but not policy. Mm-hmm. When you have punitive policy, you're making a mistake. And I want to just put up my hand and say, I don't agree, Senator, with your policy. I respect you as a politician, a very successful one. You know, she's very successful. And that's the state where I grew my kids. I mean, our family grew up in Boston, Massachusetts. We left there to move to Florida like everybody else is because it's such a tough place to, you know, this is a tough message. People really are critical about this, but somebody has to call it out because this is a competition of states now. And we don't put money there anymore. We put it in other places. And jobs are created elsewhere. Over time, this is going to diminish New Jersey, diminish New York, diminish Massachusetts, and California out of business. Out of business. El Morte. No business there. You can't do business there. I don't know what that place is going to turn into. Maybe a tourist zone, but no business. Imagine San Francisco. You can't even walk at night out in the street. Sorry.
What about what's happening, though, in other areas, not just on the coast, because you know I'm from Alabama, and with hiring workers, what you were talking about a moment ago, is a real issue. I have a family member; they moved to paper checks that they distribute on Fridays because they were having difficulty getting people to actually come to work even 5 days a week. It's a real thing. But when we talk about layoffs in the tech sector, which we talk about a bunch here, but that's not reflected in the economy as a whole. That seems specific to them. But other than that, you're not seeing the level of layoffs in that
sense. No, the truth is that 65% of our economy is companies between 5 and 500 employees. And those are the mom-and-pop businesses that make up the core and the success of the American economy. And they're doing quite well right now because the consumer is still really well-financed. And so you ask, why do we still have inflation on core items like food and energy? Because there's a lot of money sloshing around the system. It's a remarkable time. Full employment, rates going up at the fastest they've ever done since the 60s. And still, you know, people are pointing to a lot of success in small business. Most of our companies are having very good quarters right now. And people talk about tech. Tech's a little different. I mean, you know, they overhired a bit, and it got very frothy. Now they're cutting back. But tech is only 22% of the S&P. There are 11 sectors. What about the rest? They're doing quite well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's an interesting time in America. There's a lot of politics. But I think we should all be focusing on policy now. It doesn't matter who's in the White House. It doesn't matter. If you remember JFK, he was very pro-business Democrat. There's lots of great Democrats that do terrific work in business. I don't care who's in the White House. I care about policy.
Can I ask you this then finally on policy? Since you care so much about policy, you've already made your name in business. You have a lot of thoughts for a lot of lawmakers. Why don't you run?
Oh, I did run once. You know, I'm a Canadian, I'm Emirati, and I'm also Irish. So I ran for leadership in the Conservative Party in Canada in 2016. And I want to make a comment that I think you'll appreciate. I have such respect for every politician I've met since then. It's the hardest job in the world to get up at 4 in the morning, campaign in a small town, move to the next town, to the next town, to the next town, all day long, working 20 hours a day. And then the difference between celebrity and politics, in celebrity, people don't like you. In politics, 50% of the constituency hates you. And that is a whole different...
Depends on what politician you are.
I'm telling you, I don't care what side of the bench you're
doesn't
on.
Doesn't matter. Right.
There's a lot of crazy stuff happens to your family, and every politician will tell you this. I respect them. I don't have to agree with them, but I respect every one of them, even Elizabeth Warren, who I don't
appreciate
agree with anything.
Saying that.
It's
there's
true.
A way to disagree on policy
yeah.
and not attack
she's
the
a fantastic
person.
Politician. She can really raise money. But, boy, do I disagree with her on policy.
There's a discussion that needs to be had, what you were talking about, you know, places that are uninvestable right now and not really, you know.
Well, we're sitting in one right here. Sorry.
That's,
right
a bigger, that's a bigger
City.
Conversation.
We're going to ask Governor Hochul for her response.
Yes,
come
we
on,
are.
Please,
that's
please.
Debate. See it here on CNN this morning.
No money for this place. Sorry. That's
good.
It.
Thank you, Mr. Wonderful. Now, he's been saying the very same thing on several other business interviews recently, and I liked everything he said except him having to say, I'm sorry, and I'm sorry. And I'm sorry. He said it over and over and over again, folks. But why? Everything he said was true. Oh, I do take exception with one other thing. He respects these politicians. Well, I think I understand why. He hasn't been fully red-pilled. I don't think he understands all the things we talk about on this show. And I think it's just he thinks it's business as normal. I don't think he understands the occult plan to create this one-world government, the Great Reset. I don't think he understands the population reduction plans. I don't think he understands the seeding of the Antichrist. I don't think he understands that. And I think that's why he says he respects these politicians. Now, there aren't many true blue states, just blue cities. And those cities get to decide how a state's run because of their large populations and their corrupt voting commissions and their ability to do all the vote and ballot, I should say ballot harvesting. And that's the situation here in Pennsylvania where Terry and I live and operate our businesses. Now, apart from Erie, Pittsburgh, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania is a red state, folks. But on the other hand, you have states like Washington with its two Democratic-led houses. Now they're considering bills that would place a special tax on the rich. And isn't that what they're doing in California? In fact, Newsom wants to tax people that move out of the state and continue to tax your wealth. And what do they need all this money for? To support their brown shirt welfare votes and their army, the protests, you know, the mostly peaceful protests with fires. Those people are on the dole, folks. You know, it's getting pretty bad. In fact, the biggest employer in Washington State, the Boeing Corp, has already begun to move its operations to other places, including other countries like Mr. Wonderful. And, of course, the Democrats, they're going to try to keep them by offering tax cuts and all this other stuff. But Boeing's leaving anyways. Now, what about Walmart? Have you heard about Walmart, folks? Walmart is closing all their stores in Portland. Now, back on March 24th, I should say on March 24th, these stores will be permanently closed. And a couple months earlier, the CEO, Doug McMillon, warned that there was a spike in shrinkage. And that's just a nice way to say theft, in-store theft or fraud. So I'd like to play an interview of the CEO McMillon on the Squawk Box, the CNBC Squawk Box. So this is the CEO of Walmart, Mr. McMillon, and I'm trying to look it up. Here it is, Walmart. Let's have a listen to the Walmart CEO talking about store closures and price jumps. And just listen to how politically correct he is.
One of the issues we hear all the retailers talk about is what's happening with theft, with shrinkage, stuff that walks out the door. I've spoken with other retailers who have said this is a national issue, a state issue, a citywide issue. Laws matter where these things aren't prosecuted. What's it mean to the bottom line? What would you like to see people in Washington and elsewhere do about it?
Yeah, theft is an issue. It's higher than what it's historically been. And we've got safety measures, security measures that we put in place by store location. I think local law enforcement being staffed and being a good partner is part of that equation, and that's normally how we approach it.
But there have been rules that have been changed that make it not something that the police are going to prosecute, or that the criminals won't be prosecuted below certain levels. Does that matter?
If that's not corrected over time, prices will be higher. Right. And or stores will close.
And how much of that, though, do you have to go state by state and actually work on that issue? I mean, you see videos now. I saw a video of some burglars in the Apple store just literally just take, I mean, you know, taking everything that they could. And, the Apple employees were told, stand back and just let it all happen. And maybe that's the right decision in the moment, but clearly there's something larger going on.
It's really city by city, location by location. It's store managers working with local law enforcement, and we've got great relationships there for the most part, and that's the way we approach it.
So what would you like to see? What are the measures that, from the Walmart perspective and the Business Roundtable perspective, Business Roundtable perspective, that you'd like to see policymakers working on right now?
Yeah, it's just policy consistency and clarity, so that we can make capital investments with some vision.
Good luck.
That would be nice.
So there you have another leader. Business leader saying it's policy, folks. But did you notice he didn't come right out and say retail theft was the factor in the closing of our stores in Portland? But the local Fox affiliate certainly thought so. Have a listen to Fox 12 KPTV talking about the same story.
Doors are closing at the only two Portland Walmarts, and hundreds of customers are left finding a new place to shop.
Fox 12's Connor McCarthy spoke to some of those customers and joins us live now in southeast Portland to tell us how this will impact how many low-income Portlanders, rather.
Well, Pete and Riel, this location, this Walmart location here on Southeast 82nd Avenue is one of two Portland locations that will be closing. The other is in North Portland on Hayden Meadows Drive. Now, I spoke to customers at both locations, and they say the closing of these Walmarts will have a huge impact on their neighborhoods.
It's a closure that will impact hundreds of Portlanders.
I was kind of shocked.
It is a store that we go to for our things like laundry detergent, trash bags, the essentials.
Walmart is closing its only two Portland locations, leaving many customers who rely on the big box store unsure of where to go next. Amanda Paul is a regular shopper at the Walmart on Southeast 82nd. She relies on the store's affordable prices to keep her family well-stocked.
Way is the go-to store if I have to, but that's three times the prices that I would spend here. So, what are we going to do? You're going to have to go further? Well, then you got gas money, so you might as well just pay for it at Safeway at this point.
Walmart says they're closing both Portland locations because they were not meeting financial expectations. But customers wonder if it's shoplifters impacting the store's bottom line.
We got to resolve the shoplifting one way or another, because that is simply the problem. It's got to stop.
It's not just Amanda, but many households in the Lentz neighborhood surrounding Walmart rely on the store to meet their needs. According to a 2017 Portland State University study, the Lentz neighborhood is considered to be a food desert. This means there's no easy access to affordable groceries for one of Portland's poorest neighborhoods. At the time, the city named the Walmart and a Winco nearby as the closest affordable stores for groceries in the neighborhood. After March 24th, there will be just Winco.
We live near some low-income housing, mm-hmm. and I know that people are here weekly, so I don't know where they're going to go.
Well, Pete, in real, I did reach out to Walmart to see if shoplifting is one of the contributing factors for pulling business out of Portland. I also asked to see if there are plans to bring business back into the city in the future, but I didn't get a response. Live in Southeast Portland, Connor McCarthy, Fox 12 Oregon.
So it sounds like Fox 12 also knows that shoplifting is the reason. And I'll tell you why Walmart officials don't come right out and say this directly, folks. In this day and age of political correctness, that would be so incorrect politically. I mean, you've got to have inclusivity and diversity. And, you know, there's legislation out there in some states now that if you're under 21, you're not going to be able to be charged with a felony. Really, seriously, folks. And other major retail stores in Portland have experienced issues with shoplifting. Last month, the Oregonian, one of the big papers out there, reported that Nike asked city officials for permission to post off-duty police officers with the authority to arrest shoplifters at their Portland locations. Now, one of Nike's stores in Northeast Portland has been closed more than open recently because of theft. And then just last October, local news outlet KGW Channel 8 reported that they witnessed shoplifting instances at these stores, Nike, Home Depot, and Target. So once again, don't take my word for this. Let's have a listen. So this is actual news feed, and you should watch this, folks. These people are just walking out of the store with flat-screen TVs. I mean, those big ones that go for $1,000. Power tools from Home Depot and Lowe's. Just take a listen.
It's more than just shoplifting. It's organized retail theft, which got me curious after watching these videos posted online. They show people ripping off stores, like this Target in North Portland.
Y'all stealing?
I mean, it looks like they're stealing a lot of stuff, with no real fear of getting caught. In many ways, it kind of reflects some of the broader issues we're dealing with in our city, like crime, accountability, and drugs.
What's the problem? This is the kind of community I don't want to live in, man. People take shit out of the store. Because I just watched them take 8 of those sweaters off the rack and walk straight out.
Tell me about this video. I'm fascinated by it.
I just see stuff getting loaded into a shopping cart.
Yep. Sean is the guy who shot the video last September. He didn't want me to show his face.
People go about their day oblivious to these kinds of activities are going on. Unfortunately, it's becoming more and more common.
He worked in loss prevention for years.
For Fred Meyer, for Safeway, for Home Depot.
But got out because it was just too frustrating.
During that time, I've just seen things get more and more challenging and more difficult.
Most retailers, they don't allow their workers to physically stop shoplifters. It's too risky. People get hurt. Instead, they just take the loss. And the bad guys have figured that out. Last year in Portland, there were more than 3,000 cases of shoplifting reported to police. But that's likely a gross undercount. A recent survey found in most shoplifting cases, Portland retailers, they don't even bother filing police reports, citing a lack of police response, lack of prosecution, the incidents are just low level, or company policy.
I would say it's at a crisis level right now in Oregon.
How so?
Just the amount of groups that we see coming into stores on a daily basis. We see some of the same individuals that are hitting multiple retailers every single day.
Jeremy Gerard is with the Oregon Retail Crime Association of Oregon.
Who's getting hit?
Every retailer.
Big and small?
Big and small, yes.
He says some stores, again, these are individual stores, are losing as much as $1 to $5 million a year to theft.
And what kind of stuff is being stolen?
You know, anything that has a resale value is typically being targeted. Some of the items that we see that are stolen most often are fragrances, high-end purses, Levi, Nike.
So to protect themselves, stores are locking down items, like detergent, leaving shelves empty, and hiring armed security as a deterrent. But even that isn't enough. There's a stream of stolen merchandise just walking out the door.
in the time we've been driving around this huge parking lot, what's the likelihood that someone has committed a theft?
I'd say it's pretty likely. I'm almost surprised we haven't seen someone run out of doors as we drove by a few of these businesses.
It's that common?
It's that common, yeah.
These stores are being hit on a daily basis?
On a daily basis, yes.
More than once?
More than once.
This surge in retail theft not only puts workers and shoppers at risk, but also drives up prices. And the crime, it bleeds into surrounding neighborhoods.
They'll just walk from the Nike store, come down here.
Oftentimes, an armful of clothes and sneakers.
Paul Greenidge is a pastor at New Song Community Church in Northeast Portland. It sits just a block away from the Nike community store, which has become a target for thieves. They come running through the church parking lot with stolen merchandise all the time.
What's your reaction when you see those videos?
Holy cow. Did they really do that? I'm a little, it's like...
Because it's so blatant.
Yes, exactly. I was going to use the word brazen. It just, it's like, really?
The pastor believes this crime, retail theft, it tears at the fabric of our community.
It seems like this cuts deeper than just shoplifting.
Well, I think it speaks to the general idea that when the law is in place to help people do the right thing, and when the law is broken and it's not enforced, I think that's our problem. And so the people that are breaking the law have been given a free pass.
The solution? Retailers say they need more help from police, basically more officers. And prosecutors have got to go after shoplifters. Plus, there need to be tougher laws. And they make another important point here. We're not talking about people stealing food to survive. This is organized retail crime. It involves people stealing merchandise to be resold. Over the years, police have busted some major crime rings that move from store to store or city to city, which does raise an interesting question. Where is all this stolen merchandise going? I mean, just sitting outside the Nike store, we've seen all kinds of people walk right by security, then run off with armfuls of clothing right up the rack, and shoeboxes as many as they can hold. And it's coordinated, right? There's cars oftentimes sitting waiting for them as a getaway.
Can I just ask you, what do you do with all the stolen merchandise? I'm a reporter. I'm with Channel 8. Can you tell me, do you sell it to someone?
Yeah, your wife's voice.
What can we do as a community to help stop this? Do you sell it to someone? Well, that didn't get us very far. Store security did confirm all that stuff. It was stolen. Police, they offer a better explanation. Basically, someone steals merchandise. They're called a booster. They sell the stolen goods to a middleman or a fence, often in exchange for drugs or maybe drug money. It's not uncommon for drug addicts to steal just enough to get by for the day. The stolen goods are then listed and sold at a deep discount on platforms like OfferUp, Craigslist, or eBay. Sometimes they're even sold at secondhand stores or flea markets.
And a lot of this happens right out in the open. I mean, we've been watching people haul all kinds of stolen stuff out of these stores at Mall 205. At Home Depot, one guy had a backpack full of stuff, walks right past security to cash registers. Nobody stopped him. Others are running off with detergent through the parking lot, stolen shoes. One guy in particular, we watched him coming out of Target with this huge box and appliance. He goes over to some other vehicle and they talk for a while, so we decide to follow him. Well, next thing you know, they're walking down the street with the appliance. They end up at some different store, another retailer, where they unload it.
And it's this cycle that has neighbors, retailers, and police all really frustrated. Retail theft is happening at a scale we haven't seen before, leading some stores to close and others to reduce their hours. It's also helping to fuel drug addiction and contributing to this theme that in many cases, there just aren't consequences for criminals.
So there you have it, folks. Mr. Wonderful was correct. It is policy. You heard it again in this clip. It requires proper policy. It doesn't matter what your politics are, but you better have proper policy. Now, do you think these politicians are stupid? No, not stupid. Their policy is to deconstruct Western civilization. Why? Because they're reducing the population down to 500 million people. To your left, look to your right, and look at a group of 15 people, and one of you will be alive after the Great Reset. That's where this is going, folks. Jeremy Gerard, he was from the Oregon Retail Crime Association. He told KGW8 that shoplifting has reached a crisis level in Portland. It's costing stores as much as $5 million per year per store. How's that saying go? Go woke or go broke and go broke? Then how about New York City Mayor Eric Adams, I think his name is. He's already spending $5 million a day to feed and house all the illegal immigrants that he's taken on. And now he wants taxpayers to send these same people, these criminals, to college on your dollar. But it gets even more ironic, folks. Now he wants to remind the thieves that are taking and reselling these stolen goods that we just spent all this time talking about to pay their taxes on the stuff they stole.
What?
That's right, Paul. Talk about crazy and confusing. Well, enough said. Right now, it's time for Coop Talk with Henrietta. Hey, Henrietta, where are you? Henrietta, where are you? You're hiding. Why are you hiding? There she is. What? What? No, I didn't hear that. Say that again. Say that again, Henrietta. You what? Henrietta, she didn't do her homework this week, folks. There's nothing to report on in the homesteading and prepper front. Henrietta, I don't think we're going to give you any treats this week. Folks, you know, in this segment, we always cover something about homesteading and preparedness. And Henrietta let me down this week. But I'll tell you this, Mike Adams did finish his analysis of the Tractor Supply layer feed. He tested that along with five or six other feeds, and you can check it all out over at Natural News. And all I'll say is that the results are a bit confusing, somewhat inconclusive, and lacking in one of the most critical tests that he should have done. And if he couldn't do it, he should have sent them out to do it. And that's the net protein. Now, in all of my years of raising chickens and producing eggs, I've found that the single most important item is the protein percentage found in the laying mash or laying pellets. And the next single most important point, close behind, is the calcium level so that you get hard shells that don't break. And I do that by supplementing with oyster shells, crushed oyster shells. Plus, Mike gave some bad advice, folks. He suggested that you, because of these inconclusive results, Mike said that what you ought to do, and this is his recommendation, and these are his words, he said to just rotate your feed purchases between the various brands. No. That's a big no in egg farming, folks. That's a surefire way to gut and cut your egg production. I know that as a fact because I've experienced it over and over again. And I'd talk to people and I'd say, I don't know. My egg production's down. This is before all of this issue with the commercial feeds. And they would tell me, you know, Ken, to stay on a good feed. And once you find a good feed, you have to stay on it. And they'd say or ask me, did you change your feed? And sure enough, every time I changed my feed from one good brand to another, egg production would go down. So it's very important. But nonetheless, thank you, Mike, for taking time and expense to do this analysis. I only wish my lab at the plant had the equipment to do protein testing, and I'd have done it. But right now, folks, we have to keep moving, and it's time for our hopium report. Where you at, Hopium Report?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Hopium Report, where dreamers of all sorts come for their faith snort. Prepare to get high on Hopium.
Now, I could have put a couple feel-good stories or hopeful stories in this segment concerning the voter scam and the voter integrity and everything that's going on. Maybe you heard that the ERIC system for voter registration is being rejected by, I think it's 3 red states now, and it looks like it's a growing movement. Or how about Carrie Lake refusing both a bribe and pledging to continue her fight for justice in the stolen 2022 elections out in Arizona? And, you know, they were stolen here in Pennsylvania, too, folks. Come on, don't even get me started on Fetterman. But instead, I've decided to do a story on faith and revival. Now, you know, we've been reporting on what's happening down at Asbury, the Asbury Awakening, and that great revival that's sweeping across all these colleges across the United States right now. And then this movie comes out, The Jesus Revolution. Did you hear about it, folks? It's fantastic. It's so exciting. So this movie was set in the 70s when a young Greg Laurie is searching for all the right things in all the wrong places. And that's when he meets Lonnie Frisbee, a charismatic hippie street preacher. And together with Pastor Chuck Smith, who's a hammer from Cheers, they start this movement, the Time Magazine later dubbed the Jesus Revolution. Let's listen to the trailer. This is an inspiring movie. It's breaking box office records for this type of production, and it's truly hopeful. Have a listen.
Hey, Square.
I am not a Square.
I think we should invite Greg this weekend.
What's this weekend?
These people are hippies, rebels against old-fashioned authority.
I think these kids need help.
What they need is a bath.
You're passing judgment on people you know nothing about.
Maybe that's why your church is so empty.
When God walks in here, brings me a hippie, I'll ask him what it's all about, because I do not understand.
This house has a very good vibe. An entire generation searching.
Slow down, man, slow down.
Just in all the wrong places. If you want to reach my people, you need to speak to them in a language they understand.
If I bring them in, I'm going to lose my job.
We can only walk through doors open to us. In your church, that's a door that's shut.
You've probably noticed we have some guests here today. I'd like you to meet my new friends. Welcome.
They don't belong here. Half of them aren't even wearing shoes.
They're staining the new shag carpet.
They need our help. If you feel like you're misunderstood and judged, you will find forgiveness and freedom right here.
That was awesome.
Now that door is open any time of day. And if there are some who don't like that, well then that door works both ways.
All right, Pastor, let's begin.
I was most done with this, but then you did what nobody else would even dare.
The thing that we found, I feel like I belong.
You're going to need a bigger church.
Our country is a dark and divided place, but now there's hope and it's spreading.
This is your home, and I want you to tell all your friends about it.
So the Jesus Revolution, folks, it continues to break records at the box office for this type of genre. In the second weekend showing, it's domestically grossed over $30 million now. In its first 2 weeks, it's a low-budget religious film, folks, only expected to make $7 million. Lionsgate and Kingdom Story Companies, the producers of this movie and the distributors, and they said it's continuing to outperform expectations. The local theater, Terry, me, my mom, and my sister Kim are going to go next Friday. I'm going to play hooky from work, and we're going to go see the movie. So they had one showing of it, and it was probably going to be there for a week. It's in its third, going to its fourth week next week, and it's got multiple showings. Its success has caused Kingdom Story Company to add 100 theaters and like I said, increased schedules. It's up to over 2,500 theaters across the country right now. And the audience reaction is nothing short of being blown away. They're thrilled to be bringing Jesus' revolution to more cities. This is exciting, folks. And it's getting a rare A-plus grade from the filmgoers that see the movie. Now, the only other two movies that got that A-plus score from moviegoers back in 2022 were Top Gun Maverick and The Woman King. Now, Jesus Revolution is number 5 in the box office records right now. It's behind Creed, Ant-Man, Wasp, some other stupid movies. But praise the Lord, it gets even better. The actor Kelsey Grammer, who played Chuck Smith, told the USA Today in his exclusive interview that he is not going to apologize for his religious beliefs. He says that Jesus has made a significant difference in his life. And we should all be that bold, folks. We should be that bold. Amen? You, me, and everybody who believes, we should be out there shouting from the rooftops, Jesus saves. Now, Kelsey's 68 years old, and he's best known for his appearances as Dr. Frasier Crane in Cheers and on the spinoff Frasier. And he's also the voice of that SciShow Bob from The Simpsons. But he said in the USA Today that Jesus made a difference in my life. That's not anything I'll apologize for, and I've found a great peace in my faith and in Jesus. And folks, stay tuned to the end of the message because I'm going to talk to you about how we can rest in the peace of God, which is one of the fruits of the Spirit. And that's what we all need to be doing. So folks, be encouraged. Be of good cheer. There's still hope. But we have to keep moving. And right now it's time for the Absurdian Report.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the world of the absurd. This is The Absurdium Report.
Life mimics theater, but fiction is safer. The curtain rises. The show begins.
Excuse me there, I was taking a sip of coffee, folks. Anyways, Paul and I, we always have some coffee here in the morning. Isn't that right, Paul? Paul, where'd he go? Well, I don't see Paul. Anyways, this story out of the Political Insider from Arizona talks about a school board member wearing cat ears arguing that hiring teachers with Christian values is concerning. So this school board member, her name is Tamila Valenzuela, is an all-in-all-out nut job. She's arguing against hiring teachers from Christian universities, stating that she has concerns about their morals and values. And then just a moment later, she claims to full-heartedly believe in religious freedom. Well, which way is it, Tamila? Have a listen to this nut job, and that's why it's in the Absurdian Report.
Our vision in Washington Elementary School District is committed to achieving excellence for every child, every day, every opportunity. Every child. When I go to Arizona Christian University's website, and I'm taking this directly from their website, above all else, be committed to Jesus Christ, accomplishing his will and advancing his kingdom on earth as in heaven. Part of their values is influence, engage, and transform the culture with truth by promoting the biblically informed values that are foundational to Western civilization, including the centrality of family, traditional sexual morality, and lifelong marriage between one man and one woman. I want to know how bringing people from an institution that is ingrained in their values that will very directly, one, impact three of your board members who are a part of the LGBTQ community. We have added our pronouns at the dais as solidarity to let our LGBT community know that we stand in making sure that they feel protected. Are we only performing performative solidarity, or are we going to dig deep and actually look at the partnerships that we're doing?
Wow. So what do you have to say, Mika? Mika Brzezinski from The Morning Joe.
Thanks, Mika.
Wow. Mika, I know how you are befuddled by this. I listened to that, and I'm speechless, too. Tamila was actually reading the foundational beliefs that created this once great nation. Some of the beliefs and some of the core values that were on our Ivy League schools before they went woke. And she was denigrating it. She was actually looking at it as a threat rather than the actual truth that created this once great nation. But let me ask you a question, Mika. What's worse and what's more damaging to our American culture? Traditional Christian values or this nut job's woke liberalism? Well, I'd argue the latter is far more concerning, wouldn't you, folks? Look at what it's doing to our once stable society. Plus, just go check her profile out on the school district website. You know what it is? I don't have any other word for it than idiocracy. You know, like that movie? You know, it tells you everything you need to know about this nut job. And I'm going to read a couple of the lines out of it. She's a bilingual, disabled, neurodivergent, queer black Latina. She loves a good hot wing, but only with the right ranch. And things that sparkle. Now, the love of hot wings, that's pretty evident when you take a look at her picture, folks. But the things that sparkle? Does she mean like a laser pointer? Because, you know, cats love chasing that little red sparkly dot from the laser pointer when you flash it across the floor. Folks, this is also absurd. It's so absurd, in fact, that State Senator Anthony Kern out in Arizona called for her resignation over this reprehensible remark concerning Christian values. And I quote from Senator Anthony Kern's statement, "While we're facing a shortage of teachers, Valenzuela is impugning the motives of teachers with certain religious beliefs. This is not what our country was founded on." And a big amen to that, Mr. Kern. That's absolutely true. And then he goes on to say, "This is absolute discrimination. And somebody like this school should not be making decisions for Arizona and Arizona families." Folks, the truth is, this is absurd, and that's why it's in the Absurdian Report. Someone like Miss Cat Ears, who likes things that sparkle, shouldn't be making decisions on what to eat for breakfast, let alone educational decisions for our children. Think about it like this. How are people like this continually allowed to infiltrate our schools in America? Policy of the establishment. Remember, it's not about politics, it's about policy. And Mr. Wonderful cut right to the point in his interview on CNN. And then we heard it repeated again by the CEO of Walmart. Then we heard it repeated again in that detailed piece by that local station out in Oregon. Policy determines these lunatics being allowed to determine school policy. And it needs to stop, folks, it really does. Now, this next clip was so funny. And then I realized how very absurdly true it was. And Terry and I have noticed this for some time now while we're driving home on a nice sunny day, you know. We rarely, if ever, see children playing outside anymore. And that's why I put this next clip in the Absurdian Report. It's about, and I have to set the stage here for you. Now, when you were a kid, didn't you drink out of the garden hose? I think we all did. Didn't we? And if you were the first kid to drink, remember how hot the water was? Well, let me set this clip up for you. It opens up with this androgynous freak from TikTok asking, was a sink not an option? And then it flashes to this rugged-looking man that appears to be of Scottish descent, you know, based on his accent, telling a tale the garden hose. Let's just take a listen to this one-minute clip. I thought it was pretty clever, but so absurd.
When y'all are saying that y'all used to drink from the hose, were sinks not an option?
Yes, the garden hose. Of course, yes, we drank from it. You see, in our times, we weren't actually permitted in the household because that's where the grown-ups lived. We, of course, were children. We lived in this feral world called the outside. Many children today don't understand how this outside works. Most have never actually seen it except for to go to the car and back into the house. And it is a magical place, yes, but it is a hot place as well. And we would have to experience that of drinking from the water hose. You see, and the younglings, the younger of us all, they were not the wise ones. They would stand there first, waiting, so thirsty for the delicious nectar from this hose. But this hose was a viper. For that first taste was hot, hotter than the sun, and it would spit directly in her face. The wisest of us all would wait back until the water became cooled, and then we would take our drink. But of course, you are correct, we did have to do this. They were tougher times indeed.
That was classic, folks, and so full of absurdity. That nut job at the beginning, was a sink not an option? Well, no, it wasn't, and here's why. If you understood the culture that we grew up in, because if you went inside to drink out of the sink, that means you had to go into the house where your mom was working, you know, cleaning, cooking, sewing, doing all the chores and maintaining the household. And if you went inside after getting scolded by your mom for breaking the house rules of staying outside till lunchtime, she'd probably give you another chore to do. Or you'd be asked a pointed question like what you've been doing or what you plan to do, which could have ruined your afternoon plans, like I used to go down to the river on my bike to go fishing or splunking in some of the nearby caves, better known as coal mines. Yeah, folks, a buddy of mine, we used to crawl around in old coal mines. You know how dangerous that was? But somehow we managed to survive. Us kids back then, I think we were a lot smarter. And we valued our independence too much to bother with going inside to get a glass of water. So my mom, she had this loud voice, and we'd be outside all day in the summer. Sometimes she'd just bring sandwiches out to the picnic table, and we'd be out from breakfast until dinner. And she had a loud voice, and she'd yell, "Kenny!" at the top of her lungs. And I could hear that thing from half a mile away. And I knew I had 15 minutes to get home from whatever I was doing. 15 minutes to get home and to get cleaned up, or else I'd miss dinner. So I guarantee you, folks, I hurried back. And we were just fine with that arrangement. But that's how we grew up. And it's so absurd today because kids aren't even out. All they're doing is sitting in front of the TV, being babysit people that have these crazy policies that are indoctrinating our children. I have to keep moving. It's time for Ken's Corner, spelled with a K. Welcome to Ken's Corner, spelled with a K, where I'll share my life experiences to help you understand what's going on in this crazy, crazy world. So let's get started. So like I told you in the opening of the show, folks, Woody's been in a lot of Hollywood revelation of the method types projects over his career. So we've covered this in the past, but what I'd like to do is just remind you what the revelation of the method is. Now, I have this short clip to play titled Revelation of the Method, and I thought it did a very good synopsis summary of the longer clip we played, about 6 months ago on the revelation of the method from the Off Guardian. Remember, that was that long, almost 12-minute clip? Well, here's a quick summary clip, about 2.5-3 minutes long, of the revelation of the method. Have a listen.
So this is called also the revelation of the method. Dustin Broadbury of the Cogent says, according to Dr. Michael Hoffman, first they suppress the counter-argument, and when the most opportune time arrives, they reveal aspects of what's really happened, but in a limited hangout sort of way. We're told that the vaccines were harmless until Pfizer debased their own safety claims, but not before the entire world had been vaccinated. Lockdown apologists across the corporate media are now almost unanimous that lockdowns do more harm than good. This is an arbitrary about-face. This is no arbitrary about-face, but rather a carefully planned sequence of disclosures when the time is ripe. He suggests that the ruling elite are giving notice of their supremacy, declaring themselves virtuoso criminal masterminds, above the law and beyond reproach. But most of all, they're telling you in no uncertain terms that you are without recourse. These events are beyond your control, as is your destiny for that matter. Eventually, a sense of apathy and ebullia engulfs humanity, demoralizing us to the point of conceding defeat to a system we are powerless to change. Buried deep within their rule of law is a hidden constitution that states nothing happens without your consent. In this version of contract law, once the truth is hidden in plain sight, you have agreed to it. There exists someplace an unsigned contract with your unsworn oath to it. Realizing that our activities will sooner or later come to light, as conspiracy researchers like you and I unravel them, they will release information into the public consciousness. The more we are investigated, says this intelligence officer in the cryptocracy, as Michael Hoffman calls it, the more masses of people are psychologically processed by the very people who seek to expose us. It's a spiritual problem. It's a very deep spiritual problem. How are we going to solve it? Learn more. Wake up others. Prepare for what's coming. Practice meditation and prayer. I think 9/11 was a setup for COVID. Myself and sets of controls with all of the parallel opportunities that we've just seen a fraction of.
Because there you have it, folks. So TVs and movies and popular literature have been using predictive programming for generations. But some even go further. Most notably, HBO's first season of True Detective. That also featured good old Woody Harrelson. And his character's solution was put out there. And let me kind of give you the narrative on that show. It was dealing with child sex abuse and trafficking. He had this esoteric patsy scapegoat and the big bad millionaire businessmen and politicians slithering free and clear just beneath the surface. So it had all of it in there. And that's revelation of the method. And then don't even get me started on the Hunger Game movies, folks. Woody was in those too. And that was a clear depiction of the two-tier world that we're going to see after the Great Reset, where the psychopathic ruling elite are going to actually use reality TV shows to create these bizarre pop culture type 21st century versions of Gladiator, if you want to call it that. I've been a loss for words here, folks. So there's also Woody's other dystopian future-like flicks. You know, he had 2012, Planet of the Apes, and a couple Zombieland movies, I think it was. So what he's cultivated is this personal brand, a good time Charlie, so to speak, yet the fruits of his labor show it to be anything but that. He's been a demoralizing weapon used against this nation, against we the people, and our mental well-being. It's the revelation of the method, folks, but I have to keep moving. And right now, because we're out of time, it's time for Back to the Future, where we take something from the past and bring it back to the future. Now, I have to cut this short here, and I have to dive right into this. So I'd like to wind the clock back to March 13th, 1913. That's the birth date of a man named James Shelby Downard. Now, maybe you've heard of him, maybe you haven't. But Wikipedia, and this is the go-to source to see whether the deep state is trying to promote this guy or trying to disparage this guy. And here they refer to him as an American conspiracy theorist, of which have been published in various anthologies from Farrell House, examined perceived occult symbolism, twilight language, and synchronicity behind the historical events in the 20th century. Well, guess what, folks? I think we've demonstrated fairly conclusively here on this show that that's exactly what's happening. And then it goes on to say he's also known for his addition to Masonic conspiracy theories, with his belief that the Freemasons were responsible for the assassination of President John F. Kennedy through a ritual known as Killing of the King. Now, that's where I first learned about him, from his essay written, forget how long ago. I learned about it back when I was doing research for William Cooper, and it was titled King Kill / 33, Masonic Symbolism in the Assassination of John F. Kennedy. Now, I don't know if you remember, but FBI Director, what was his name? Colby? Not Colby. Oh, geez. Just forgot his name. The one under Trump that Trump fired. Anyways, he did an interview concerning the whole Trump, anti-never Trump thing, and he had his children's toys lined up like Dealey Plaza. That's this occult symbology, folks. So there's a book out that was published by Michael Hoffman. It's called Stalking the Great Whore, The Lost Writings of James Shelby Downard. Now, Shelby Downard and Michael Hoffman were associates. And thank you, Mr. Hoffman, for publishing this work. It's available on Amazon, and I'm going to be getting a copy of it. It's part biographical, part theoretical, and downright conspiratorial. That's how the description talks about it. We follow our hero across the 33rd latitude, littered with all the ghosts and human wreckage that he encountered in his pursuit of what they call the Great Whore. Now, you know, that's from the Book of Revelation. And this is all pointing towards the seeding of the Antichrist in the Great Tribulation, folks. Now, this is how the whole concept of the revelation of the method has evolved. So you go back to this man and his work. So Downard inspired Hoffman, who inspired Cooper, who inspired me, and now we have this show. So let's get back to Woody Harrelson and the revelation of the method for a minute. You know, in that book, The Twilight Language, there's this theory that's introduced called the freeze-thaw theory, and that came out from Michael Hoffman. And this is covered in that book, Twilight Language, and it's a sequel to the secret societies and psychological warfare that I've talked about here on the show. And in Hoffman's words, and we heard it in the clip before, the revelation of the method is mostly, although not entirely, relating to imposing humiliating, mind-numbing psychological domination over innocent victims by first freezing, that's denial and cover-up, the facts of the crimes perpetrated against we the people, and then the revelation of the method. The revelation of the method, folks. That's how this works. So how's this apply to what's going on right now? Well, we've been talking about the J6 videos and Tucker Carlson's collapse. So we heard Tucker building up for it a week ago. We heard Tucker expose it. And now I have this little clip where Carlson exposes Ray Epps' J6 perjury. Have a listen.
One of the enduring mysteries of January 6th is the role that intelligence and law enforcement agencies played in the events of that day. We know there was some number of undercover federal agents in the crowd at the Capitol. Officials have since admitted that under oath. But what exactly were they doing there? The January 6th committee worked hard to hide the answer to that question. We do know from contemporaneous videotape that a mysterious figure called Ray Epps encouraged the crowd to go into the Capitol. For some reason, Epps has never been indicted for that. But there's no question he did it.
We need to go into the Capitol!
Under public pressure, the January 6th committee finally interviewed Ray Epps. Epps told the committee that he never entered the Capitol and therefore never committed a crime. His text messages showed that at 2:12 p.m., he boasted to his nephew that he had, quote, orchestrated the protests at the Capitol. He admitted he helped get people there. Yet, curiously, congressional Democrats consider Ray Epps an ally, not an insurrectionist. Tonight we can tell you that at the very least, Ray Epps lied in his sworn testimony to the January 6th committee. Epps testified that when he sent the text messages to his nephew, he had already left the Capitol grounds to return to his hotel room. That is not true. The surveillance footage we found shows that, in fact, Ray Epps remained at the Capitol for at least another half an hour. You're seeing that on your screen now. What was Epps doing there? We can't say, but we do know that he lied to investigators. The January 6th committee likely knew this too. Democrats had access to the same tape, yet they defended Ray Epps. No honest investigation would do that.
So there you have it, a great truth for everyone to see, but nothing's going to happen. This is the freeze-thaw of the revelation of the method. So I learned this from Cooper, who learned it from Hoffman, who learned it from the man in our Back to the Future episode, none other. I just forgot his name, James Shelby Downard. James Shelby Downard, folks. But nothing's going to happen unless you and countless millions of others stands up and say no more. Yet people die suddenly, and the doctors are baffled. That's how the deep state controls people that are too hot to handle. Plus, folks, I still don't trust Fox News for all their lies concerning the 2020 and 2022 election results. And in my humble opinion, folks, this entire J6 video release narrative by Tucker Carlson is nothing more than a diversion from some other plot or black swan event that's still hatching, so to speak. You know, Hunter Biden's laptop was all over the news, and now it's gone. Talk about confusion and chaos. Well, what's the anecdote to all this confusion and chaos? Well, like I said at the beginning of the show, it's the peace of God, folks, one of the fruits of the Spirit. And that can only come by resting in Him. And that means that we have to know the ways of God, like we've been talking about over the last 2 weeks. And unless we know the ways of God, folks, we're never going to rest in His peace. So last week and the week before, we learned that the difference between merely knowing His works versus knowing His ways is the difference between so much. You know, it's the difference between a relapse into our old ways and rest in the peace of God. It's the difference between mere infatuation about the works of God, being a miracle monger, so to speak, versus an intimate relationship with Jesus Christ as you walk with Him and talk with Him through the thick and thin of life. It's the difference between merely being a testifier, giving your testimony about what Jesus did like Kelsey Grammer did, and being a teacher of His ways like Moses was. And what my desire is to share with you the ways of God. And then it's also the difference between being merely indifferent when somebody tells you, oh, I have cancer, and you say, I'll pray for you, and being an intercessor, somebody who fervently and powerfully prays for that individual. Get some ways that we can literally know God's ways. So let's remember, Moses faced this overwhelming task. He had to lead the chosen people, the children of Israel, through the wilderness and into the promised land, the land of Canaan. And he faced all sorts of obstacles. And it was fraught with all sorts of difficulties. And in the midst of all this, he said that great prayer. And read it for yourself over in Exodus chapter 33, verses 12 through 14. Now, folks, it's my firm belief that the part from verse 13, and I'll read that part to you, ought to also be our prayer. And Moses says, if I have found grace in thy sight, show me now thy way, that I may know thee, and that I may find grace in thy sight. Folks, we all need to pray that. And there are two ways that we can be acquainted with God. Remember, we talked about that in the last 2 weeks. We can know His works. That's what most people do. They know His works. That's what the nation Israel knew about God. And that's worthy of His praise, folks. Or we can know His ways. We can know God like we knew our mom and dad when we were kids. And that's worthy of our worship. Notice Moses didn't pray, Lord, show me your works. And he didn't, because he already saw plenty of God's works. Instead, he prays, Lord, if I've got this gigantic task to do, I want to know your ways. And praise the Lord, God answered that prayer. The Bible says, and this is in Psalm 103, verse 7, He, that's God, made known His ways unto Moses and His acts unto the children of Israel. So Moses knew God's ways, and he worshiped Him, whereas the children of Israel only know His works. And when the times got rough, they didn't worship God. They worshiped a golden calf. So I'm confident to say that Moses continued to worship God through the thick and thin, whereas the Israelites, who only praised God, ultimately ended up worshiping that graven image. because they only saw what God did. They didn't know God in any other way than reality, the ultimate reality here on earth. And Francis, if you're listening, a shout out to you. I haven't thought about the ultimate reality since our days at St. Vincent. Whereas Moses knew something more. What did Moses know that the rest of Israel didn't know? Moses knew God and his ways through a relationship with him. So there are these two levels of knowledge about God, knowing God in reality and what he does, or knowing God in relationship on his ways. So some know God's works. They see what God does, and they do that in reality, whereas others know God's ways, and they have insight into his character, and that's a relationship that transcends the here and now and goes into the spiritual realm. You know, we aren't physical beings having spiritual experiences. We are spiritual beings having a temporary physical experience, and that's the truth. So I'm telling you, folks, there are perilous days ahead. And my prayer for all of you out there are that you might learn the ways of God as we grow in relationship with him. And this will bring you a fruit of the Spirit, which is literally the peace of God. And we need that in these troubled times. So in these past two weekends, folks, we learned the difference between knowing his ways in relationship and knowing his works in reality. And I just talked about all those. And I want to keep moving. And I want to continue this, or I should say conclude this, by saying or answering the question, how can we know the ways of God? Well, first off, let's look at some of the ways that we won't know the ways of God. So we're never going to truly understand God through human reason and human ingenuity. It's just not possible. The Bible says in Exodus chapter 33, verse 12, and Moses said unto the Lord, see, thou sayest unto me, bring up this people, and thou hast not let me know whom thou wilt send with me. Yet thou hast said, I know thee by name, and thou hast found grace in my sight. Now, there were some things that Moses didn't know, and God didn't tell him. And we know that's God's way, if we know what the prophet Isaiah said in 55, verse 8. Where Isaiah wrote, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. So don't ever make the mistake of thinking that God's ways are just like your ways. They're not. Or that God's thoughts are like your thoughts. Isaiah 55 verses 8 and 9 conclude in verse 9 with this following passage. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts. So we're never going to know God's ways through human ingenuity. It's just not possible. And if you ever think you know God, you got him all figured out, and you got him in this nice little box or this package, that's not God, folks. That's an idol you formed in your mind. So how do we get to know God's ways? Well, we get to know God's ways through intimate, face-to-face relationship with God. The Bible says, face to face. That's in verse 11 of Exodus 33. Read it for yourself, folks, if you don't believe me. And then he says, this is God talking to Moses, my presence shall go with thee, and I will give thee rest. So folks, in the midst of all this chaos and all this confusion, we can find rest in God when we receive his, the Bible says in Exodus 33, verse 19, and he said, I will make all my goodness pass before thee, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before thee, and I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. So all of this points to an intimate relationship with God. So Moses had a relationship with God the Father, which is very similar to what we can have with God through our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And that didn't come by mere observation or seeing God do things like opening of the Red Sea. And it doesn't come by interrogating God or reasoning with God. It only comes by an intimate, trusting, loving relationship with God. So how are we going to know the ways of God? Well, there's no way other than opening his book, the Bible, and reading about it, learning about it, and having the Holy Spirit teach you as you read. Then we can see not only the works of God and the stories that the Bible tells us, but then it becomes this awesome, intimate, answer to prayers. When God will say to you personally and privately, my presence will go with you and I will speak to you face to face. That's when the logos knowledge of the word becomes the rhema knowledge of the word. And those are two Greek words used in the New Testament concerning the word of God. So take it from logos and move it to rhema, folks. And in conclusion, just remember that the purpose of all the counseling and preaching that teachers of the word do isn't to solve your problems. So I'm not here to solve your problems. I'm here to bring you and them into the presence of God so that you can know God face to face and have an intimate relationship with him. And when we seek his face and we learn his ways, we're going to find rest in our souls. Amen? And that's my prayer for all of you today, folks, that you come to know the ways of God in the midst of all this chaos and confusion. So, Father, please seal these truths on the hearts of all who have listened today, and may they come to know you through Jesus Christ in an intimate relationship, folks. So all you have to do is cry out, Lord, save me, and he will, folks. I love y'all, and in the words of Winston Churchill, stand and stay the course, folks, and never give in.
Never give in. Never give in. Never, never, never. In nothing, great or small, large or petty, never give in, except to convictions of honor and good sense. Never yield to force. Never yield to the apparently overwhelming might of the enemy.
And remember, that same power that rose Jesus from the grave, that same power that will reveal these truths, turning logos to rhema, that Holy Spirit lives in you and me if we believe. I love y'all. Let's lift our hands up with Jeremy Camp and praise the Lord for that same power.
We're living in a very defining time in our generation where fear is creeping in and the uncertainty of the unknown is everywhere.
I can see what is raging at my feet. I can feel the breath of those surrounding me. I can hear the sound of nations rising up. We will not be overtaken. We will not be overcome. I can walk.
There's an urgency like never before in my heart to proclaim the good news of Jesus Christ. To show a world that looks like there is no hope, that in Jesus alone you will find that hope and peace. To stand up in the midst of adversity and tribulation, and to show the unconditional love of our Savior while not shying away from speaking the truth of God's Word. Cry out for change in our world, but many times we are left asking, how can I make a difference? What do I do next? The truth is, we can do nothing. In our own strength and our own power, we will fail. But Jesus himself said to the disciples, I leave with you my spirit. In Romans 8:11 it says, if the spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, will also give life to your mortal bodies through his spirit who dwells in you. Let's step out in his power. Let's proclaim the name of Jesus in boldness and love. And when the attacks come from all sides, walk in the understanding that greater is he that is in us than he that is in the world, because the enemy has been defeated and the victory is in Jesus.